everybody, welcome into the back room. I'm Andy Ostroy. We have Jane Lynch with us today. So exciting. We'll get to Jane in a second, but first, thank you for tuning in. We appreciate you listening, and we'd love to hear your comments. So email us at backroomandy@gmail.com and or post on our social media, and we'll read some feedback next time. And if you like the podcast, please follow or subscribe and rate and review, and you'll be notified every time we post a new episode. So, Jane Lynch, she's a 5-time Emmy winner and is known for her portrayal of Sue Sylvester on Glee. She currently hosts NBC's revival of Weakest Link and appears in Hulu's Only Murders in the Building. Additional television credits include The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, The Good Fight, Criminal Minds, 2 1/2 Men, and she hosted Hollywood Game Night. Jane's film credits include Wreck-It Ralph 1 and 2, The Three Stooges, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Talladega Nights, Role Models, Julie and Julia, A Mighty Wind, and Best in Show. Jane, welcome into the back room.
So good to see you, Andy. Thank you.
Likewise. And we learned the other day that we have George Hahn in common.
Yes. A lot of people have George Hahn in common. He gets around socially. He's one of the most social people. I'd get exhausted looking at his Twitter feed.
He is.
But I love him. He's great. He's met him over Twitter.
Yeah, he's same here. He's one of those people that, and he's been on the podcast. He's one of those people that when you meet, you feel like you've known him your entire life.
That's one of his gifts.
And so the next question becomes like, well, then how did I go my entire life without this guy in my life?
That's how I feel about him too. He was instantly familiar to me on some level, and I actually reached out to him and said, let's be friends. Mm. And we walked his dog, a very safe first date.
Lenore?
yeah, both of his dogs, Lenore and Smokey.
And speaking of dogs, you have 3 rescues?
Well, I have 1 now, but we had up to 4 before this one we have now. We adopt seniors, my spouse and I, and they usually live about 3 or 4 years after we get them.
Oh, so you get them when they're much older. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So no, we're down to 1, and this dog, I think, is younger. We don't know exactly how old this dog is. Mildred, we've had her for about 3 years, but she's very... Yeah, Mildred.
That's my mother's name,
very,
by the way.
Is it? Oh, it's a beautiful name. Mm-hmm. She's very tender. She's very kind of... There's like trauma somewhere, so she doesn't do well with other dogs. But she's just a love. She has just become the most wonderful dog.
And you had a dog named Bernice also.
Bernice was one of the last crew. Yeah, she was a black Cocker Spaniel. We lost her about 3 years ago. We also had a black Cocker Spaniel named Rumi at the same time. And he was a bit of a hellion. And he attacked my spouse. He attacked Jennifer, and so
Ooh,
we found
a little jealousy.
Home for him. Yeah. He's a one-person dog. So we found this guy in San Diego who said, "You know, I'm not getting married again. I'll take him." So we have road trips down there to visit Rumi and Daryl. Of course, he's a wonderful guy, and so it was a happy ending to kind of a scary story.
I love the fact that you name dogs human names.
I know.
That is the coolest thing.
Too.
I remember when David Letterman used to talk about his lab, Bob. And ever since, so when I met George, he's got Lenore.
Right.
So it's like, I think it's the coolest name. My dog is, I have 2 dogs, Ringo, but then I have a Willie. Ringo is because I play drums.
Oh.
But Willie is.
You do play drums.
Yeah,
for you.
So I think dogs and cats should only be named things like Mildred and Bernice. And
I know. Oh, that's right.
Bob.
Mildred and Bernice. When I was in college, my roommate had a dog named Kevin. I just loved that for a dog named Kevin.
That is the best right there, Kevin.
But we kind of named them like old aunts. Mm-hmm. You know, like,
okay, just you
Aunt
imagine
Mildred.
Like being in a dog run and hearing somebody scream, Kevin.
Yeah, isn't that great?
And a dog
I love it.
Running. So I want to peel the onion back a little bit, go back to childhood before we talk about your very illustrious career. You grew up in Illinois, so you're a Midwestern
gal.
Yeah,
a small town. Mm-hmm. A small town in, a suburb of Chicago, Dalton.
Mm-hmm. How much of that small town girl is still in you?
Yeah, I'm sure it's still there. I think it's more generally just kind of a Midwestern kind of sensibility that people... Mm-hmm. ask where I'm from, and when I say this, you know, a suburb of Chicago, they go, oh, because there is kind of a particular Midwestern vibe that's kind of, there's a humility to it. Sometimes it's false.
Mm-hmm. And, as it should be.
But it's, yeah. But there, you know, especially being an actor from Chicago, a wardrobe person once said to me, I can tell someone from Chicago because they hang up their clothes. Because we knew growing up in the theater, if we didn't hang up our clothes, well, they weren't going to get hung up.
My daughter, Sophie, is definitely not from Chicago then. And your family, your dad was a banker and your mom was a homemaker.
Yep.
Uh-huh. And was there like any artistic stuff happening in the house at all?
Well, a little bit. You know, my dad loved to sing, and mm-hmm. so did my mom, but my dad was really good, and he was a great harmonizer, and he loved musicals, so did my mother. So we always had music playing. I'm a pretty good harmonizer, so I take after my dad in that way, and I love, you know, I sing all day long. Kind of to the annoyance of people who kind of hang out with me because I tend to sing the same phrase over and over again.
Which is?
And it's absent-mindedly for me. And that it every once in a while, someone will say, Jane, no more. Either get a new tune or stop singing or do it, you know, sing it inside internally.
What's the tune?
My brother plays the piano. I'm sorry?
What's the tune?
Oh, anything.
Oh, uh-huh.
I mean, I'll just get a phrase in my head, like everybody was kung fu fighting.
And then you're just saying it over and over and over again.
Just that phrase. Yeah, just that phrase.
Well, it sounds like you were on key there. You sounds like you got a little bit of a voice.
Well, it depends on the key you're in, and that's the key I picked. So uh-huh. I was on key, yeah.
And you a theater major, and you got your master's in fine arts. So you knew pretty early on what you wanted to do.
Oh, yeah. I knew from the moment I could think and have an imagination that I wanted to be, first of all, on television, because that's the first thing I saw. And then when I started seeing school plays as I got a little older, I knew I wanted to do that. Absolutely. The lights would come on and you're in a whole different world. And I wanted to be a part of that magic.
Mm. And so this is like when you were one of these kids at like 3 and 4 performing in front of everybody. And...
Kind of. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Always kind of the funny one, the wiseacre. I loved to make people laugh and I loved music.
Mm-hmm. And was your family supportive of that as you were pursuing this?
They were baffled.
Or were they like, no, there's no money in acting. Oh God, what is she doing?
Well, not even that. It was like, who goes into acting? who does that? You know, yeah, you watch. They're not thinking, well, we see people on television
right. And
they decided to go into acting,
mm-hmm.
but that's like 5 people. What makes you think you can do it? You know, that, and it was just baffling to them. And then when I, I started doing plays like in school and I changed my major unbeknownst to them at Illinois State University to theater in my sophomore year. And, They were like, okay, all right. But yeah, you know, you need something to fall back on. You need to learn how to type, all that stuff. But as I got more and more serious about it, grad school and then, you know, performing in Chicago mm-hmm. and they would come out and see this stuff. And, you know, I was in theater companies in Chicago mm-hmm. and I started doing commercials and all this stuff. And they were mm-hmm. like, okay, I guess she's doing it.
Mm. Well, she is doing it and she did do it. I mean, mm-hmm. I started to, you know, put my notes together. I went to your IMDb and like, man, if you were a gangster, they'd say your rap sheet is like 10 miles long. I think it's literally the longest IMDb I've ever seen. Like you constantly work and have.
I said no to nothing and I showed up for everything. I never had a thought, especially when I was younger of, oh, this might be embarrassing. I never thought of that stuff.
But you've made amazing choices. So happy to be invited. Which makes it even more fascinating is that it's not like, I mean, look, I'm sure every actor has things that they're, you know, like, oh, why did I do that? But like your list of credits is unbelievable and it's nonstop. And I've thought about this and I think the greatest actors are the ones that have that thing, that Jane Lynch thing that nobody else has. Like Paul Rudd.
Oh.
He's got his Paul Rudd thing, right?
Will Ferrell has his Will Ferrell. You
have the Jane Lynch thing. Nobody can do it.
Cute.
So it's like,
well, thank you, Andy.
They got
a nice thing to say.
They got to get Jane Lynch. They can't, you know, my daughter's in casting and it's like, we talk about this kind of stuff all the time. And there are certain roles where you can just take your choice, your pick of so many qualified people. But like there's those roles where they say, like, it's like a Jane Lynch character. And then it's like, well, then we have to have Jane Lynch because not anybody can do Jane Lynch.
It's funny because sometimes the greatest curse, especially when I was in commercials and, you know, auditioning for commercials and voiceovers, if it would say a Jane Lynch type, a lot of times Jane Lynch wouldn't get it.
Oh, really?
It'd be funny. Well, you know, I will do it. Yeah. But when I was working, I didn't necessarily see the Jane Lynch type, but I will get, people will send me, you know, screenshots of auditions, and they'll say a Jane Lynch type, and I'm like, well, you know, Jane Lynch is available, but no, they want a Jane Lynch.
There's a
type.
Comedian I can't remember his name, and he tells a story like that where they wanted a Joe Blow type, and he's like, I'm Joe Blow, and he's like, no, we need a more than me, I am the guy.
Yeah.
And you did Steppenwolf Theater Company for many years, and then
I wasn't in the company. No, I did a couple of plays there, but I wasn't in the ensemble.
Okay, and also Second City.
Yes, I was in the touring company there, and I understudied Bonnie Hunt on the main stage.
Oh, okay,
which was a joy because her stuff was always so funny.
Mm-hmm. And so during this period, did you have like the typical all the shit jobs? Were you waitressing and?
For just a little while. I worked at RJ Grunt's in Chicago, which is a restaurant, and then I temped. I would do go to offices, you know, when I needed work. But by the time when I was about 27, and I'd graduate, you know, I'd been in Chicago since I was about 24 as a professional actor. When I was about 27, I started doing a Shakespeare company, or maybe even younger than that. And we toured to schools doing scenes, Shakespeare scenes. And so we got paid for that. So I was making a living. I mean, barely, but enough where I didn't need another job. And then I got in the touring company for Second City right after that. And I made enough money to live on that. Mm. So I didn't go too long doing those jobs.
Not a whole lot of dues paying then, huh? The proverbial.
Yeah, well, dues paying, yes, where you're, you know, performing, you're getting some money for it, but you're like in a church basement or something like that.
And, so many actors, it just takes them such a long time to get that break. And Adrienne Shelley, she left school early and got those Hal Hartley films so early on. She always felt bad that, like, you know, I hear all the struggling actor stories and I didn't know what that meant. I got a starring role like when I was like 21 years old.
Well, I wasn't starring in roles until my first big role was when I was 50. Mm-hmm. You know, I was kind of doing the voiceover guest star. I was making a living doing a little bit here, a little bit there. But yeah, no, I didn't. I was 50 when I got Glee.
You were a real working actor and you were supporting yourself, which is what, like,
yeah, and I was before that too, for sure.
Know, I
think it's like 1%. It's a crazy, crazy statistic.
So your first film was Vice Versa. That was in 88. What do you consider? I mean, your career is so long. And a lot of people, of course, think of Glee when they think of you. And that was such a big hit. But there's also so many other things that people think of you. The mockumentaries and role models and all the Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly films and all that. But what do you consider your big break when the career just sort of took a next level leap?
I would say Best in Show in 2000. Mm. I went from being, a guest star where no one knew my name. I would show up in different shows, but it wasn't like anybody knew, put it together and said, oh, it's this person. And in Best in Show, it did. Mm. It that's when it changed. And I people knew my name. Not everybody. Mm-hmm. Obviously, those films are kind of have cult. Well, maybe a little bigger than cult.
Count me in.
Good. Yeah.
I quote Corky St. Clair from Waiting for Guffman almost every day.
Do you really? What's your favorite quote?
Well, it's just when he talks about his wife, all the stuff about his wife, you know, it's just so funny.
Yeah, what was her name? I buy all her clothes.
So you met Christopher Guest working on commercials, right?
I worked on a commercial. Yeah, I did. I was doing a lot of commercials that year. 1999, I had like 5 nationals. I bought a house. It was a really great thing. I auditioned for a Kellogg's Frosted Flakes commercial. And at the callback, I didn't know who the director was. And at the callback, I walked in and there was Christopher Guest. And I had, of course, known him from not only Spinal Tap, but more recently at that time, Waiting for Guffman, mm-hmm. which just blew me away.
Me too.
Oh, I just wanted to do that. Mm. I want to do that. And so I got that commercial, and at lunch, he said, "Do you know Sean Masterson? He's a really funny guy on Twitter too, but he's the Second City guy from Chicago." And he was, although we did this in L.A., we played husband and wife in that commercial. And at lunch, Chris said, "You know, I do movies," and I was like, "Yeah, I know, I sure do know." And he said, "Maybe we'll get to work together again." And I was like, "Oh God, wouldn't that be great?" And then ran into him at a restaurant when he was casting Best in Show. And he said, "Come to my office, young lady."
And, what a great movie. And then you did Mighty Wind and For Your Consideration. Those movies are so mm-hmm. different. The mockumentary space, which to me, why aren't there like 100 more mockumentaries? Like, they're so good and so fun and funny and silly.
What was it like working on them versus other projects? As a style, though, I think something like, you know, like any style in comedy, it has a shelf life before it becomes reductive and copying. And you know, I think the last time it was used to great effect was Modern Family. You know, that they were always had those interviews with them, and it was kind of like a documentary. It was great because, well, it was 100% improvised. You know, we didn't have any lines.
Oh, wow.
All of his films? All of them.
Wow. Yeah.
He has, it looks like a regular script. It'll say exterior, you know, dog show parking lot or something like that. And it'll say, you know, Sherry and Christy talk about blah, blah, blah. And then we improvise from there. And there are plot points we have to get in. But he just rolls the camera. He rolls it. Like the first time we worked together, Jennifer Coolidge and I, and we actually shot the last scene in American Bitch was the first thing that we shot. And, so rolling, and we're improvising, and we're going. You hear the whir of the camera. It's like there's no one's calling cut. So you just keep going, and we both kind of learned you just keep going and don't worry about it because he's going to put it all together in editing. But of course, when you first do it, you feel obliged to give him something at every moment, and he doesn't want that. He's more interested in behavior and being funny, and that's why he hires particular people, you know, for. That know how to do this.
Right. You had the background from Second City and others.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, Second City is nothing like this kind of improvising. Second City, I always say, is kind of a masculine improv. You get to the joke. It's kind of like get to the orgasm. It's like no foreplay. You get to the joke. And with Christopher Guest, he wants us, we're allowed to meander. And we're not thinking about the joke. But naturally funny people will end up being funny and have a few jokes here and there, but it's mostly, you know, like he said, he can tell within 5 minutes if someone can do this style. Mm. He said instantly, he can tell instantly.
Mm. Well, there's so many, you know, brilliant actors in those films, like Fred Willard, like mm-hmm. that kind of humor mm-hmm. is just so genius.
But, and what's funny about Fred, he planned everything he was going to say. The rest of us kind of just showed up in the camp. He would give you your lines. Because he loved a good joke. He goes, "Now you're going to set me up in this, Jane. You're going to say this, and then I'm going to say that." I
was like, so okay, he was scripting the improv.
He was always scripting his improv.
That's crazy.
Then he was great at improv, too, you know, without coming up with it. But he loved to get some of his jokes in because he was an encyclopedia of knowledge and jokes, and he'd want to get some stuff in.
Is it as terrifying as it seems to do that kind of thing, to do a film that has no script?
Yeah, well, sort of. You feel really safe. And, you know, I saw Waiting for Guffman, and I don't know how to explain it. I just really resonated with it. But I was still afraid, and so was Jennifer Coolidge. And it was our first Christopher Guest adventure, and we did it together, and we kind of held each other's hand. But after you do the first movie, at least for me, and I bet my fellow improvisers would say the same thing. Once you see how he puts it together and how he crafts the performance, you're much more comfortable. Like in A Mighty Wind, I was so comfortable and had so much fun and it really enjoyed myself and didn't have any of that walking away at the end of the day going, I gave him nothing.
Right, because if you do five or six takes or something, like he's going to take somebody's line from take six and put it with something
no,
else.
No, that's not how it works.
No?
That's not how he does it. What he does is he shoots them. He shoots one, he shoots the master and you're improvising, improvising. Mm-hmm. And then he comes in and he says, now do the same thing. So you kind of have to remember what you did. And he comes in a little closer. But no, you're right. He'll like grab it. He might grab like a reaction of somebody. Mm-hmm. But in the, you know, in the moment, and he might focus on that. And that's what makes us laugh so much. You know, the kind of the innocuous where, you know, like that kind of stuff that mm-hmm. he puts that in. But basically we do the same thing. Once we improvise, we're kind of locked. Mm. And then he comes in.
It would seem like to the non-actor in us that it'd be so terrifying to do that with a group. But I would imagine on some level, like because it's a group, you just end up kind of riffing together. It just almost organically kind of stuff happens.
And, you know, you know that, you know, the first rule of improvisation for any kind of improvisation is yes. And you never deny what the person says to you.
Right.
You go with what they say. And so when you have that trust, it makes everything a lot easier because you don't feel like you're in it alone. It's like playing house. You know, when you play house as a kid, I don't know if you ever played house as a kid. That's maybe a girl thing. But
house, I played doctor. That was my favorite game.
I bet you did. But you know how
in my
just
house,
go along
I played doctor
it.
In the house.
There you go.
So what did you do during the strike? How'd you keep yourself busy?
Not a hell of a lot. I was almost kind of happy that we weren't working. I'm glad that we went on strike. I'm glad we got what we ended up getting. But did nothing. You know, I do voiceovers, and so I was able to do those. Mm. It was a different contract, and I do animation. But it was really nice to sit at home. It was nice to be. We just moved into a house in Santa Barbara in the last couple of years, and it was just nice to be home.
So you know, decided when you're moving, you're going to go to the ugliest place in the country, Santa Barbara.
Right. Yeah, we wanted to punish ourselves.
Yes. That's some deep punishment there. You know, it's funny. I have a lot of actor friends, and they would say to me, like, the pandemic, I sat around for 2 years doing nothing, and then that kind of gets out of the way, and then the strike comes, and now I got to sit around and do nothing again. You know, the rest of us were able to go back to work and do whatever we do, but, you know... show business kind of shut down for a while because of that.
It did. But, you know, in the pandemic, I worked within 2 months of the pandemic. They just had those crazy COVID regulations, where you're in masks up until, you know, rolling and then you take your mask off.
Testing right before. Yeah.
Yeah. And testing every day.
So you've worked with the most legendary comics, Will Ferrell, John C. Reilly, Sacha Baron Cohen, Paul Rudd, Steve Carell, Fred Willard, Eugene Levy, Catherine. That just has to be the funnest thing in the world, right?
It is, yeah. And what I love about funny people is it's the great equalizer. You know, when we were doing Talladega Nights, that was all improvised too. There was somewhat of a script, but we basically improvised it. I'm trying to remember now because, there's more of a script doing the, there was a script for the 40-Year-Old Virgin and there was a script for Talladega Nights for sure. But they also allowed us to improvise around it. And, you know, they were so the best joke wins kind of a thing. It was mm-hmm. the great equalizer. I loved working with like Will. He's and John C. Reilly and Steve Carell and Judd Apatow. And, you know, they were just so supportive and, there was a real kind of carefree, light kind of atmosphere. And, you know, you just felt taken care of, you know.
Do you?
Because really, I'd rather not improvise.
I was just going to ask you, do you have a preference when working on a film, like someone like a Judd Apatow, all about free form and, you know, improvising and all that. And then you have other directors who are like, read what's on the page. Here's how I want it done. Like, where do you land in that? Or is it just depend on the project, depend on the director?
I guess it depends. It depends on the project. Like, I love doing The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Talladega Nights because there were scripts. And then, you know, they come up to us, you know, like Judd would call me over and whisper something in my ear and give me, you know, that whole thing about fuck buddy. I mean, I didn't come up with that. That was him. So that was great. And there was certainly room to improvise. Like, sometimes they'd say, you know, let's do this one without the script. But it was mostly there was a script. So I guess it depends. But when somebody who's you know, not like a Judd Apatow or an Adam McKay, who directed Talladega Nights. And they say, you know, if you want to improvise in this, go ahead. And it's kind of, that's, you know, I kind of, you either improvise or you don't. Mm. You know, it's especially with someone who's not like a comic director. Let's just stick to the script.
so you kind of like to be directed one way or another. Like if it's like,
I don't like to be directed at all, but
no, I mean, like if it's someone like Apatow, who he has a vision for the improv, you know, versus
absolutely.
A director who's like, hey, why don't you improv? Like if it's not, if the lead isn't coming from the director, so to speak, and it's just
exactly.
up to you, then it's a little less
and then
safe,
it feels
perhaps.
Arbitrary, mm-hmm. you know, like, oh, I'm going to improvise in this one and they're not going to use it because it feels arbitrary.
Do you ever feel put on the spot, like with someone who is directing something who is not necessarily like an improv master, but because they know you, they think you are the master and it's like, okay, Jane Lynch, go ahead and improv. And is that like a little bit more pressure or?
Well, what I say is, well, no, the script is great. I'm going to stick with the script. Yeah.
I have a friend who's an actor and he's like, God, without a script, I'm nothing, man. Nothing. Like I need a script.
Yeah.
I would imagine that it could be so funny. I've talked to Cheryl Hines a million times about, you know, working on Curb. Like if you're bent that way, if you have that in your training, of course, like doing improv could be so much fun, but I would imagine for a lot of other people, it could be absolutely terrifying.
Oh yeah. Well, those people won't end up on Curb. Do they 100% improvise?
No,
on
I think
Curb,
it's like
they
the way you explained it before. It's like there's a basic outline of like, here we're going to go into a coffee shop and this is what's going to happen and then go.
Right.
You know. But that cast, I mean, but you know, the people you've worked with, like it's impossible not to think of those people not being able to brilliantly improv, you know, the people.
Oh yeah, they are. They're amazing.
With.
Curb is really a singular show. Mm-hmm. Nobody does a show like that. I mean, and it's really particular people who can do that. And I couldn't. I auditioned for it once in the middle of it, like probably 5 or 6 years ago. I had done Best in Show and Mighty Wind and all that stuff, and I just was terrible. Mm. I was awful at it. I did not get cast.
Do you have a sense when you work on something? This always fascinates me, whether it's musicians or whatever, like when they're in the studio recording something, do they know that this is going to be a big hit? Like when you've taken on roles, I mean, you've worked in some great films, comedic films, you've worked on some, you know, amazing TV shows, still do. Do you have a sense when you're starting out a project like that, like, oh, this is going to blow up?
No, you work on it with, you know, you kind of don't think about that. Because you got bigger fish to fry, like doing your best.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes you maybe have a hit inside. Like I had a hit about Glee shooting the pilot when the kids sang Don't Stop Believing. And I remember and my character was like watching them and seething. And I thought, oh, my God, this has real heart. And those kids are so good. Mm. And I might have said this before, if anybody's read an interview with me before, I'm repeating myself. I had a feeling, cause I knew musical theater people and we're pretty rabid about musical theater, but it's not a lot of people in the world. I thought, well, it will this could possibly have a small following, but it will be a rabid following. And it ended up bigger than that, which was great.
The interesting thing about musical theater, whenever something is produced musically, whether it's La La Land or Glee, it becomes a huge hit because it just seems like the
music
market
is huge.
But it feels like the pencil pushers are terrified of musicals, which is why
I think so too.
Only one comes out every, you know. But when it's
done, on
television
film?
Or film, like it's just like it's a genre that always seems to work, but yet there's just not enough of the content because it seems like it's. You know, everything
is siloed.
It's
very expensive. Mm-hmm. It can be very expensive. Mm-hmm. If you're doing songs that already exist.
Right.
It's been done a couple of times remember the scene? I don't know if you remember this. The singing detective in like the 80s was terrible. I mean, so I think that it's a big risk to take. But if you follow the rules of musical theater, which, you know, even Glee didn't all the time, which is you don't sing unless you have an absolute reason for expressing yourself in song. It kind of doesn't work. But yeah, I think, you know, music is so powerful, though. Like, I look at commercials now, and they don't use, only a couple of commercials will use like a theme song. But remember when we were growing up, you know, there was a theme song for every commercial. And I think that's so catchy. I wish people would go back to that. I think it's such a strong weapon.
Plop, you know, plop, like, fizz, how do you handle fizz, a hungry what?
Man? Yeah, right, right. Exactly, exactly.
Right, the jingles. Plop, plop, fizz. And where now, are the jingles
and
today?
Now there's a Liberty, 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 which I don't think the commercials are great, but it's kind of nice that they have a bit of an unimagined.
Well, now they brought a kid into it, so now at the end, great. It's like, Liberty. Have you seen the new Liberty ones with the little kid? The baby? It's like a baby saying Liberty, Liberty.
Oh, it's not funny. Yeah, a lot of their commercials are not very good. Mm-hmm. But they do use, you know, there's something to recommend them in that they're using a little bit of music. I think that's, you know, that's powerful.
It is. It's so true. The jingles just don't exist anymore. And every once in a while, you meet somebody. Yep. Like, I've met friends who were like, oh, my dad was in Africa. Oh, my dad wrote blah, blah, blah. And you're like, oh, my God, your dad wrote, like, plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is.
Richard Marx, you know, Richard Marx, the wonderful performer. Sure. His, you should get him on your show. He's such a great guy. And he's a good friend of George Hahn's and mine.
Who isn't a good friend of George Hahn and Jane Lynch? Richard Marx. I'm writing that down.
Yeah, Marx. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know that. Mm-hmm. But his dad was a huge jingle guy in Chicago. Huge jingle guy. He wrote so much of it. And he was also a producer of commercial music. But yeah, he wrote a lot of that.
I think a lost art.
That we hear. I can't think of one of them right now, but he would tell you.
Do you do ads these days?
I
voiceovers?
Yeah, I actually direct some commercials. So I'm kind of... I direct Illinois Office of Tourism commercials, and I love doing it. I love, we have music that goes into it.
Illinois Office of Tourism.
That not bad at all.
Yeah, there's a jingle for you. You can have that free.
Thanks. Thank you. I love doing it. I'm inspired by the commercials of days gone by. They, you know, there just seems to be like kind of maybe there's too many cooks in the kitchen, but there's a stagnancy. There's a lack of imagination. And
the advertising business in general isn't what it used to be. So Sue Sylvester, that character is just un-fucking believable. I love Sue Sylvester. How much of, were you able to help shape that, especially over the course of the seasons? Like,
well, not really. It was one of those things. I mean, yes and no. Ian Brennan created her. You know, at the direction of Ryan Murphy, said, you know, I want a cheerleading coach as the villain and, you know, go create her. So he created her and he wrote most of my lines, Ian. And Ian's from Chicago, too. And we have kind of the same sensibility. So it was a really great coming together of personalities. And, you know, we really I was so grateful for him. I really got what he was writing and he got what I was putting down. And so it was a really good, synthesis of two people coming together. So we were both really lucky that way. But, you know, he basically wrote every line and created her and really resonated with me. So I was able to embody it.
Mm-hmm. And was that show just like one of those projects, just like a right time, right place kind of thing? Because it just exploded. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the only explanation other than just there was a good show, of which there are a lot, that it just landed in our culture at the right time, in the right place.
I think that whole microcosm of high school, of being bullied in the hallways and having a refuge in the choir room where you're safe and you raise your voice in song, I think it spoke not just to kids. You know, it gave kids a sense of belonging and that, you know, it was a recognition of how tough it can be in school. That you know, if you go into this room where you just sing and everybody, it's the great equalizer and you feel safe and you have your people. I think that extends to like adulthood too. Like a lot of adults love that show, you know, because this can be cutthroat in the world. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very cutthroat out there in the world. Sometimes it could be a very, you know, the mean streets can be a very hard place to, you know, feel safe and feel supported. And then you, it's almost like having a family. You go into this room for a couple hours a day, the choir room, and, you know, it's all about the music and it's about each other and it's about supporting each other. And it's refuge, basically. Mm. And I think that spoke. And then music on top of it, I think, you know, making a joyful noise is something that really moves people.
And it went on for years. Was it something when it was over, you were like, okay, this is, it had its place in time in my life?
Yeah.
Or were you really just like, oh, shit, I can go on longer doing this?
Yeah. I you know, I got to a point in my career where I didn't look at that. If something lasted, that was great. And if it didn't last, that was great. I don't, mm-hmm. and I still kind of feel that way. It's, I kind of roll with it.
So it's like a fate thing. It's just, it'll go as long as it's supposed to go.
It's, oh, now I'm going here. Mm-hmm. Right. I don't know what's next,
and
but
one thing
I'm
leads
not
to
doing
the next
this anymore.
And, right.
Right.
Like just a bunch
of links. I didn't suffer it. Mm-hmm. And I also didn't celebrate it. I was just, okay, we're moving on. Mm-hmm.
And that show has some odd tragedy associated with it.
Yeah.
Three of the cast members in their 30s died tragically. Mm-hmm. I mean, how?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't even know what to say. It's like, I don't even have a question about it. It's just, it's an observation that it's just so weird to have that.
It was really, it was a kind of a weird, I don't know, curse thing or whatever, but it was, you know, just so tragic. Mm. Just horrible. Just horrible. And you know about that.
Yeah, I do. I do. Well, that's why, I do notice those things, and it affects me in a different way. It affects me because I've been through that with my late wife, but also I have children in their 30s. So I look at that, and it's like, wow. I mean, those weren't just actors on a show. They were people. They were sons and daughters. Like, it's just, but it's just the fact that it was multiple people from the same cast, in different ways too.
Completely. Three completely different tragedies. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Party Down, another great show, another great character.
Oh, yeah.
And that's coming back.
We did a season. I don't know if it's coming back again, but we did a season after, I think it was 12 years. Our first season was 13 years ago. And then we did another season premiered last year, so we did 6 episodes.
Right. Oh, so that's okay. So that's it's not a continuing.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Not that I know of, but we'll see. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great concept. Great cast.
Yeah. Brilliant. You know, that's Paul Rudd.
Your
pal Paul Rudd created that.
Yeah. And the game show. Do you like doing that? Two game shows.
Uh-huh. Hollywood Game Night, which was, very hands-on. I had to do 5 games every show, and it was an hour show, and we had 3 celebrities and 1 civilian on each team, so it was an exhausting, exhilarating thing. And now I do The Weakest Link, which is, you know, I stand behind a podium and I ask trivia questions, so it's, you know, a lighter load, but so much fun because I love trivia.
Were you a game show fanatic growing up? Like, was
not a fanatic. I liked them. And now, I mean, I love hosting. I just absolutely adore it. It's a lot of fun. And I so admire the people who are the contestants and how they're able to, in spite of the fact that a camera's in their face and they have, you know, you can hear the clock going, they are able to stand up there and give the answer. So it's always a wonderful thing to behold.
And marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Mike. Co-producer Jen loves you in that and says that it's such a different kind of role for you. And do you like when you're able to get into a little darker, more dramatic-y kind of? I mean, that role
I love great writing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The dual nature of the character is I would imagine.
Yeah, the dual nature. Well, it was one of those things that when I read it, I was like, oh, this is fantastic. You know, Amy and Dan are such good writers. And just, you know, I knew exactly how I was going to play both of them. Immediately I went, okay, this is this and that is that. And I could not wait to get there and do it. I loved it. I loved doing it. The writing's so good. And I got to work with, you know, most of the time with Alex Borstein. And she is just, what an amazing scene partner. What an actor to work with. Mm-hmm. She's so funny and she's so smart. And so fast and so right there, you know, we just had a blast.
There's a scene when you meet Midge for the first time and you're talking about comedy and you ask her, like, who are you? What's your persona? and she didn't understand.
What's your gimmick?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. But you're, of course, 100% right. And you're that whole character you have is all about persona. You created a character that you play on a stage.
And that's what women needed to do back then. Mm-hmm. Whereas a guy could stand there and tell jokes, you know, like Jack Benny, even though, you know, he had kind of like a gimmick. He did this or whatever. Right. Everybody had, the guys had like a point of view, but the women had to have a persona, and it had to be, you know, like a character, and it had to be something demeaning. It had to be something like the, you know, the loudmouth housewife, like I thought, or like the Phyllis Diller's, you know, who she was the, you know, kind of the loud, loudmouth. I kind of based it on her. She wasn't like a Queen's housewife, but you had to have, at least that's how, like Moms Mabley, you had to have kind of a, you know, a girl who couldn't get a date with a guy kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And then Midge comes along and she's got a point of view as like the guys do. You know, she's not wearing anything in particular. She's an observational comic. And I think that made Sophie crazy because she worked so hard to get this kind of like fat housewife character going. And here's this young upstart being herself.
She wears a fat suit.
Yeah. She was just being herself.
And so you modeled the character after Phyllis Diller, but also Toady Fields a bit, which is aging myself.
Absolutely.
With that.
Yeah, me too.
Like a combo. Yeah. It's a perfect combo of those two. And Midge was like Joan Rivers, really. Kind of, that's what it was based off of.
Yeah, a little bit. But Joan Rivers used to do jokes about how ugly she was and how I can't get a date with a guy.
Right.
And Midge doesn't do that. So even, I mean, in fact, I put a little Joan Rivers in my character too. But so Midge was an anomaly. She was, you know, like the guys, she just said, I've got a point of view and I'm going to talk about it. I'm not going to put on a wig. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to talk about how ugly I am or that I'm a divorced woman or, you know, she just, you know, saw it as, you know, called it as she saw it. Mm.
And do you think it's much easier today for women stand-ups than it was back then in a real meaningful way?
I think that I just saw Ellen DeGeneres has some new material and you know, she's a brilliant stand-up. Mm-hmm. She's, you know, if I think today, if you have, I mean, it's an art. You can't just stand there. It's art. You have to have a point of view and you have to be precise with your words and like John Mulaney and Nate Bargatze is a new guy that I discovered. I just love him. And Ellen, you know, they are precise. Mm-hmm. Their jokes are meticulously, you know, framed. Mm-hmm. And they perform them as if it's coming off the top of their head. That's the key. And I think that if you're a woman, you've got that much mastery, I think it's easier for you today. It not so much, you know, maybe 10 years ago, but I think it's easier. But you still, you know, you have to be precise and, you know, it has to be, there's an art to it. It's like sometimes when you watch a stand up and you're kind of nervous for them, it hasn't reached the level of art for them yet. But if you're kind of relaxed, sitting back and letting this person take you on a journey, that's the best stand up. That's when it becomes, you know, you're a master of it.
And now you're working on Only Murders in the Building. That's got to be a lot of fun, you know, Steve.
It is, yeah.
More icon. You know, you have this thing about working with icons.
Yeah, Steve Martin, I know. Marty Short. Mm-hmm. And what's her name? Meryl Streep is on. I just said, what's her name
for
Meryl Streep?
Paul
she's still on. Doing it. She's mm-hmm. she's doing some. Yeah, and then, of course, Selena Gomez. Mm-hmm. And I played her mother or her stepmother in called Another Cinderella Story, like, 15 years ago when she was 18, so it's really sweet to see her.
Mm. And so, and
all
what
grown
is,
up.
What is next for you?
I don't know. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I never know. Mm-hmm. I'm right here doing this.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of Cinderella stories, you are a Cinderella story. And
I'm lucky girl.
Yeah. I mean, if I was going to be an actor, I'd want to be you. You literally, you have the career that I would love if I was an actor. You work with all the people I would love to work with.
Sure.
And
we
love your work and keep doing what you're doing. Make a lot of people happy.
Thank you so much, Andy.
Thanks for doing this. And hopefully you'll come back sometime.
My pleasure. Yeah, love
to. And let's have lunch with George one day when you're in
town. Yeah, that would be great. That'll be great, yeah.
All righty, take care.
All right. You too. Take care.
Bye-bye. This episode of The Back Room was edited and produced by me, Andy Ostroy. It was co-edited and co-produced by Maddie Rosenberg and co-produced by Jen Hammoud. Our theme song was composed by Andrew Hollander, and our logo was designed by Cricket Langell. And special thanks to Patricia Wind. Please take a moment to rate and review the podcast, and also follow or subscribe. Until next time, keep your eyes on Washington, Hollywood, and your own backyards, and have a great week.